Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today we open with our Capitol report and some major developments in Washington, D.C. San Diego Republican Congressman Daryl Issa is calling for the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate the Trump administration, and we'll tell you why on today's show. Now, if that reminds you of Watergate, there are a few other troubling parallels between Donald Trump and Richard Nixon, including efforts to obstruct an investigation and attacks on the media. And we'll share some details on those parallels in our special report. We'll also have news about Trump's efforts to fast-track construction of a border wall. Then in local news, learn how you can get a high school diploma through the county library. Hear about flu deaths in San Diego County and what you can do to stay healthy. We'll tell you about a land conservation group looking for investors to help buy and preserve Star Ranch in Campo here in East County, and we'll have news about a brand new health care clinic in Santee devoted to providing health care for low-income people. Our newsmaker interview today is with Victor Crosswhite Contreras, a proud member of Descendants of Early San Diegans. He'll be sharing details about the upcoming Twain Fest in Old Town. They're looking for scripts that bring to life historical figures from our region's colorful past, including communities here in East County. The winning entries will be performed at Twain Fest by professional actors. And as a special treat today, Victor, who is also an actor, will be reading one of last year's winning scripts, bringing to life the infamous bandito Joaquin Murrieta. And finally on today's show, we'll be re-airing one of our favorite episodes, taking you on the road to historic Julian, where we'll talk with the town's historian, visit a gold mine and go panning for gold, and chat with a baker about the new gold drawing tourists to Julian, its famous apple pies. So stay tuned for today's episode of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Gene Carpenter with East County Magazine's Capitol Report. Calls to investigate the Trump administration's troubling ties to Russia and whether Russian interference influenced the U.S. election are starting to gain bipartisan support. San Diego Republican Congressman Daryl Issa is calling for an appointment of an independent prosecutor to investigate ties between Trump and his administration officials' ties to Russia. In a TV interview with Bill Maher, Issa, who formerly chaired the House Oversight Committee, said that Attorney General Jeff Sessions cannot be in charge of the investigation because he served on Trump's campaign. Nor can any other presidential appointee, Issa said. You're going to need to use a special prosecutor's statute and office. Issa added that it is not yet clear if crimes have occurred, but he stated, the American people are beginning to understand that Putin murders his enemies. Issa added that Putin has also waged cyber warfare in the Ukraine and Georgia. We need to investigate their activities, Issa said, of potential Russian meddling in the U.S. election because they are really bad people. Congresswoman Susan Davis, a San Diego Democrat, agrees. In a press release, Davis states, this latest report of the White House pressuring the FBI to comment on a pending investigation can be added to a list that keeps growing, of reasons to have a full, bipartisan and independent investigation into the 2016 election and the president's Russian ties. Congresswoman Davis is co-sponsor of a bill to create a commission to look into the 2016 election. She adds, I urge any Republican colleagues to join with Democrats to not only pass this bill, but amend it to include an investigation into the influence Russia has on the White House. Republicans should not enable bad behavior.
This is Miriam Raftery reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ. In a statement reminiscent of Richard Nixon at the height of the Watergate scandal, President Donald Trump has slammed media outlets that reported on his administration's troubling ties to Russia. Trump, in a speech to members of the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, said media outlets, quote, shouldn't be allowed to use sources unless they use somebody's name. Shield laws protect media outlets from revealing names of confidential sources. The most famous of those was a source known as Deep Throat, who after his death was revealed to be Mark Felt, associate director at the FBI. Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein met regularly with Deep Throat, who provided evidence that Nixon obstructed justice to block investigation into his knowledge of the Watergate burglary at Democratic headquarters. Those revelations led to the resignation of President Nixon, indictments against 69 co-conspirators, and guilty pleas or convictions of 48 co-conspirators in the Watergate scandal, including top Nixon administration officials. Donald Trump specifically attacked a report in the Washington Post, the same newspaper that exposed the Watergate scandal. The story he didn't like cited 9 unnamed sources, who confirmed that National Security Director Michael Flynn discussed sanctions with Russia's ambassador before Trump took office, although Flynn told Vice President Mike Pence that that conversation never occurred. The Washington Post story about Flynn's lying led to Flynn's resignation, and the administration never challenged the truthfulness of the story, only voiced anger over leakers. Serious questions are now being asked by prominent congressional members and the FBI over evidence that Russia hacked Democratic databases and Hillary Clinton's emails, the cyber version of a Watergate break-in. Other troubling issues the probe could focus on include concerns that Russia created fake news stories circulated online to help win the presidency for Trump, allegations that Trump's business ties in Russia pose conflicts, details on key Trump advisors involved with Russian dictator Vladimir Putin and, allegedly, Russian organized crime figures. Trump's campaign staff was also in regular contact with Russian government officials, according to CNN. And a British intelligence dossier claims that Russia holds compromising sexual videos and financial scandal information with which it could blackmail President Trump, who has repeatedly praised Putin and pro-Russian policies. Trump has dismissed all allegations regarding Russian ties by himself or his cabinet officials and aides as, quote, garbage. However, he has refused to release his tax returns, which might show Russian business ties and whether there are conflicts of interest or not. He has not softened his pro-Putin stances. Instead, he has attacked media reports on those allegations, which, if proven, could amount to impeachable offenses or even treason. It is common for national media to maintain a network of confidential sources in the intelligence community, the White House, and other administration offices. This is done to prevent retaliation against whistleblowers. Ironically, before his entry into politics, Trump himself was sometimes a confidential source who leaked stories to the press. Trump's paranoia about the press begs the question, is Trump pressuring media to reveal their sources in order to assure truthful reporting? Or is it to expose leakers and provide his administration with the ability to find and fire whistleblowers? Trump further retaliated against major media outlets that reported on the Russian controversies by taking the unprecedented step last week of banning them from a White House press briefing, including CNN, The New York Times, Politico, The Los Angeles Times, and The Washington Post, as well as some overseas major media outlets, including Britain's BBC and The Guardian. But right-wing outlets such as Breitbart News were admitted instead, in a clear effort to punish, intimidate, and control the mainstream press. Trump recently referred to the media as the enemy of the people and has labeled reputable media outlets such as CNN, ABC, CBS, NBC, and The New York Times as fake media, a statement that is, quite simply, false. Besides attacking the press, as Nixon did only behind closed doors, another Trump action is also drawing parallels to Nixon. CNN reports that White House Chief of Staff Rance Priebus asked both FBI Director James Comey and a second FBI official to debunk media reports about communications between Trump associates and Russians known to U.S. intelligence back during the election campaign. Now, according to CNN, the FBI refused the White House's request. CNN reports such a request from the White House is a violation of procedures that limit communications with the FBI on pending investigations. And indeed, memos in 2007 and 2009 specifically prohibit the type of communications that occurred between the White House and the FBI, an action that arguably could be interpreted as an effort to obstruct justice. Trump personally attacked the FBI publicly in a pair of tweets on February 24th, which collectively read, "The FBI is totally unable to stop the national security leakers that have permeated our government for a long time. They can't even find the leakers within the FBI itself. Classified information is being given to media that could have a devastating effect on the U.S. Find now," Trump concluded in all caps. With those words, Trump cannot blame efforts to intimidate the FBI on lower-level staff. And lest we forget, Article 1 of the impeachment measure passed by the House of Representatives in 1974 against President Richard Nixon, who resigned to avoid impeachment and likely removal from office for criminal obstruction of justice, read as follows. Richard M. Nixon, using his powers of his high office, engaged personally and through his subordinates and agents in a course of conduct or plan designed to delay, impede, and obstruct the investigation of such unlawful entry, to cover up, conceal, and protect those responsible, and to conceal the existence and scope of other unlawful covert activities, whereas Richard M. Nixon, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office. Now, Nixon also ordered the CIA to quash an FBI investigation into the Watergate scandal. Does that sound familiar? NBC reports that a new poll finds that 53% of the American public now want Congress to look into the alleged communications with Russia by Trump and his inner circle. Only 25% disagree, and 21% had no opinion. John Dean, the former White House counsel to President Nixon, said in an interview on Democracy Now! That he sees, quote, echoes of Watergate, unquote, in Trump's actions, including Trump's attempts to cover up the investigation into his Russian ties and his disdain for the media. Dean recalled Nixon's remarks caught on that infamous tape in which he called the media the enemy and threatened to wiretap the press to find out who was leaking information to the media. The White House Correspondents Association has formally objected to Trump's shunning of major media outlets and asked that colleagues who are admitted share information with all media. Trump on Saturday announced he will not be attending this year's White House Correspondents Dinner. Ironically, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, at a Politico dinner in December, was asked if incoming President Trump would continue his campaign practice of barring certain reporters. Spicer responded that there is a big difference between campaign events in a private venue and a government entity, adding, "I think we have a respect for the press when it comes to the government. That is something you can't ban an entity from. Conservative, liberal, or otherwise, that's what makes a democracy versus a dictatorship." And yet now, Spicer himself has banned media outlets that published investigative reports critical of the president, a practice that he himself noted is normally associated with dictators. Indeed, Stalin, Hitler, and other dictators worked to shut down a free press to stifle voices of dissent. America's founding fathers, by contrast, recognized such dangers, which is exactly why they provided protection of a free press in the First Amendment to the Constitution. Dan Rather, the former CBS News anchor who now runs the news site News and Guts, had this to say following Trump's banning major media outlets from Friday's press gaggle. "The barring of respected journalist outlets from the White House briefing is so far beyond the norms and traditions that have governed this republic for generations that they must be seen as a real and present danger to our democracy," Rather said, and he concludes, "These are the dangers presidents are supposed to protect against, not create."
President Donald Trump is pushing forward with plans to fast-track building a wall along the 2,000-mile-long U.S.-Mexico border. On Friday, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection announced that it will begin accepting bids on March 6th to build the wall and will allow only 4 days for contractors to submit their concept papers and build prototypes due March 10th. Construction contracts will be awarded starting in mid-April to build the massive wall, Associated Press reports. The project would be built in phases, starting by extending fencing and then later replacing existing fences with a solid wall. However, such expenditure should require approval by Congress, which has not yet indicated when or if it would approve the money needed to build the wall. Congressional leaders have estimated it will take $12 to $15 billion to build the wall, though an internal Homeland Security memo estimated the cost at $21 billion to secure the entire border. Most of San Diego County already has a border wall, or at least a fence, meaning San Diego taxpayers will largely be paying to build a wall somewhere else. The wall, if built, will fulfill a promise made by Trump to his supporters during the campaign. But it has drawn strong opposition not only from immigration advocates, but from others who argue that the hefty cost is money that could be better spent for other purposes, such as reducing the deficit, helping the homeless, improving public education, or preserving funding for the arts and public media, which Trump says he wants to eliminate. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Rebecca Williamson with an education report. High school graduation is a rite of passage for many, but sometimes circumstances prevent someone from getting a diploma. Josh Mitchell, adult services manager at the El Cajon branch of the county library, observes a lot of them say life happens. They had to drop out for whatever reason, start working, and the next thing you know, it's 10 to 20 years later. But now, the San Diego County Library is offering adults 19 years and older a way to graduate with a program called Career Online High School. It's a partnership between the county, state libraries, and the Gale Company that provides educational and research resources. The El Cajon Library started offering courses in early 2016. Students accepted into the program receive a full scholarship, and openings are still available. Students have seen this as their golden ticket, says Mitchell. They can do this from home and adapt schoolwork to their own lifestyles, which is especially important for people who have children. Any resident of San Diego County can apply for the program. Students can transfer up to 14 credits from their former high school and complete the online courses in 5 to 18 months. They may also work toward a career certificate in any of the 8 different fields. Library staff directs would-be students to an online self-assessment and prerequisite course and then conducts in-person interviews before accepting applicants. Once enrolled, the student is provided with an online academic coach to help guide the student to be successful. The program doesn't award a general education diploma, known as a GED, but an actual high school diploma. A high school diploma offers more opportunities than a GED, said Mitchell. Graduates are more likely to qualify for higher education and job opportunities. Robert Johnson of Lemon Grove saw an opportunity with Career Online High School and ran with it. Johnson, who is 55 years old, spent 34 years as a trucker and at one point had his own business, but both went by the wayside. You don't get anywhere by giving up, Johnson says. He researched online courses and found the Career Online High School a good fit. He also won a scholarship. In addition to getting his diploma, he's taking courses for an office management certificate. He hopes to finish school by June and believes that earning his career certificate and his diploma will open up new doors of opportunity, including going to college and furthering his career. He concludes, "It was always a dark cloud over my head, not having a high school diploma. In the end, when this is behind me, it will be a great sense of accomplishment for me."
This is Gene Carpenter with a health report. 5 more people in the San Diego region died from complications from the flu, the County Health and Human Services Agency announced last week. A total of 49 local influenza deaths have been reported this season, compared to just 17 at this time last year. To date, the people who died ranged in age from 31 to 98 years old. All except 3 had underlying medical conditions. So far this season, 3,786 cases of the flu have been diagnosed countywide. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says people should continue to get vaccinated since the flu seasons can last through March and April. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that everyone 6 months and older get a flu shot every year. It takes 2 weeks for immunity to develop. Vaccination is especially important for people who are at high risk of developing serious complications from influenza. They include people with chronic medical conditions like asthma, diabetes, and lung disease, even if symptoms are under control, and pregnant women. Other steps you can take to avoid catching the flu are to wash your hands frequently, use hand sanitizers, clean commonly touched surfaces, stay away from people who are sick, and if you're sick, stay home and avoid contact with others. The flu vaccine is available at doctor's offices and retail pharmacies. If you don't have medical insurance, you can go to a county public health center to get vaccinated. For a list of locations, visit SDIZ.org or call 211.
At its meeting on Monday, February 27th, the Campo Lake Morena Planning Group will hear a presentation on backcountry land trusts' interest in potentially acquiring Star Ranch. George Barnett, Vice President and Director of Land Acquisitions at the Land Preservation Group, will speak and answer questions from the public. A proposal to build 455 homes, as well as business structures on the site, is still in process with the county, though the developer ran into financial challenges. If the land is bought by another developer instead of a land preservation group, the county could move forward on the environmental impact report to process the development plans. Barnett told East County Magazine, "We're at the earliest stage of trying to put together a group of interested organizations that maybe collectively are interested in the property. That would require a joint effort to fund the roughly $7 million asking price for the property, plus setting up funding to care for the property long term." Barnett says he hopes to get community input on what they would like to see happen to the property. The planning group will also review applications for filling a vacancy on seat 7. If you would like to apply to serve on the Campo Lake Morena Planning Group, you can call Chairman Billy Joe Jannon at 619-415-6298. The meeting will be held at 7 p.m. on February 27 in the Mountain Empire Community Center, Campo. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Kim Cooney.
This is Gene Carpenter with news about a brand new healthcare facility serving low-income residents that is now open in East County. Santee Family Medicine is located on Town Center Parkway in Santee. The facility is the fifth health center locally operated by Mountain Health and Community Services, a nonprofit that has provided health care to people in our communities since 1975, regardless of their ability to pay. Mountain Health says that it strives to serve these communities and adjoining regions with respect, dignity, and cultural sensitivity, providing a safety net for essential health care, community, and social services. For more information about the new Santee Family Medicine Center, you can visit mtnhealth.org. That website again is mtnhealth.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Victor Crosswhite Contreras. Victor is an actor and a proud member of Descendants of Early San Diego. Victor, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Miriam. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Now, we're here to talk about Twain Fest, which is coming up in August. Victor, can you tell us a little bit about what Twain Fest in Old Town is all about?
Named after Mark Twain.
Yes, and it's a celebration of literature of the 1800s. And certainly the Old Town State Park is an appropriate venue for this because it celebrates the history of California and the history of San Diego in the 1800s. Now they're hoping to expand the event. It's been a yearly one-day event, and they're pursuing grant funding to expand the event because it's been so popular to multiple days. But it is targeted for August. Whether we're going to be able to expand this year or not, where I'm not entirely sure. But one of the activities of Twain Fest is presentation of authors of the 1800s, but also historical characters, people that actually lived in the San Diego region,
So I understand that you are having a script writing contest, and it's not just for people who were residents of Old Town back then, but for the actual real-life historical stories of people from throughout the San Diego region. That would include East County and beyond. Tell us about
Absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, because San Diego was a commercial hub that included much of what is now Mexico, East County, all of East County, all the way to the mountains and into to the desert, and all the way north, probably up to San Capistrano. So all of that would have been the San Diego region prior to the border.
So what are the rules for entering the contest?
Last year it was a contest. Now we've decided to change the format a little bit, and it's not a contest rather than a submission. And we're looking to build a library of scripts, because as this event grows, the presentation should grow, and we should have more stories, more of a collective. So we're hoping to build a library. We're hoping to make this an annual event.
Wonderful.
Now we are looking for real life people, people that actually lived here during the 1800s, to tell a little bit of their story.
So first person.
First person. And speaking to visitors to San Diego, and telling something about the time. So it's not just their personal story, but it could be foods, it could be events, it could be culture, it could be clothing, things about the 1800s. So it's a story, and it gives you some information about the times as well.
I've seen some of these presented at past Twain Fest events, and they're absolutely marvelous listeners. Now, are there limits on how many words it can be or anything else that folks should know?
It's not limited by words, but limited by time. So we're looking for 2 to 10 minute segments.
Okay.
So we're not looking at major scripts. 2 to 10 minute segments, they would be compensated. Those that will be selected will be compensated $100. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that we're just doing for free. So they would be compensated $100 for the permission to use the scripts and have a professional actor actually perform them during Twain Fest.
Wonderful.
Yeah, the deadline for submissions is May 31st. The scripts will be read and evaluated, and those that are selected will be announced at the annual Descendants Weekend, which is the last weekend in June every year.
Very good. Now, you can get an application at descendantsearlysandiego.weebly.com. That's W-E-E-B-L-Y.com. Descendantsearlysandiegoweebly.com. Or you can check out the Descendants of Early San Diego on Facebook. And now, listeners, we have a very special treat for you today. Victor Crosswhite Contreras, who's with us today, is going to be reading a script that was a winner performed in last year's Twain Fest. And this is the story of Joaquin Murrieta, a famous bandito, and apparently his story was the basis for the character Zorro of movie fame.
Absolutely. Zorro is actually a compilation of multiple bandits of the time, and so they created the legend of Zorro, but primarily based on the real-life adventures of Joaquin Murrieta.
Fascinating. What else would you like our listeners to know about Joaquin Murrieta before you do the reading?
Well, actually, there's a lot of information in the story. Let me perform it for you first, and let's get into questions afterwards.
All right.
Which might be more provocative. We've been able to take some of these performances actually to schools, and we're hoping to do more of that. And we found that to be very provocative, not only when we perform them in Old Town, but especially when we perform them in schools, because it provokes a lot of questions and information, and we can discuss a lot of the history and events of early San Diego.
Well, very good. Then without further ado, we bring you, brought back to life from the 1800s, Joaquin Murrieta.
Yo soy Joaquin, and I rode with Murrieta and his band of men in the 1800s in California. We were soldiers of fortune. Freedom fighters. And yes, bandidos. The newspapers, they would recount that Joaquin Murrieta was in Sacramento, Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, San Diego, all on the same day. This be impossible. But you see, there was more than one Joaquin. Joaquin Murrieta had been a soldier in the Mexican army during the time of the war between the United States and Mexico. When Mexico she lose, he go back to his pueblo. Soon after, gold She was discovered in these Californias, and people from all over the world, they come to this California to seek their fame and fortune. So too, Joaquin. He bring his family to California, and he stake out a claim to look for gold. But in the new California, there were new laws. The new government, they passed the foreign miners tax. This was where anybody could collect a tax on foreign miners. Foreign miners were defined as anybody who was not of European blood and did not speak English. So many of the people that were born and raised and grew all their life in California were considered foreigners in their own land. Joaquin, he make his claim. He set up his camp. He go to hunt for food for his family. When he returned, he found this camp destroyed, and everything of value should be taken. His beautiful wife, she was raped and killed. Her body lay on the camp floor. His children close by with their heads bashed in. He knew, as an ex-Mexican soldier who had just fought a war against the Americanos, he could find no justice in California. So he took up the life of a bandido, and he organized these men and trained them in military fashion so they had efficiency and they were hard to find. They would steal from stagecoaches, from miners, them rich Americanos, and they would give to the Spanish-speaking people in the area. And so the people, they would help Joaquin. And he would yell, "Yo soy Joaquin," and they would cover for them and misguide the law enforcement that chase after him. We wear cape around our bodies so the people would know, "Yo soy Joaquin," that we were with Joaquin Murrieta. But they not see who it is because of the cape, and they do not know what Joaquin Murrieta looked like. But they know one of his lieutenants, Three Finger Jack, Tres Dedos. They know him because he lose a finger in a fight, and his hand only have three fingers. They find Tres Dedos. And so they set up an ambush where they kill all the men with Tres Dedos. They cut off the hand of Tres Dedos, and they cut off the head of Joaquin, and they take it on display up and down the California, and people pay ticket to go see the head and the hand. The head and hand, they be on display in San Francisco during the great San Francisco earthquake, and the head and the hand, they be lost again, and the Americanos are still in search of Joaquin Murrieta. But was that head Murrieta? Because after all, I am a bandido, and I too am Joaquin.
Marvelous. What a powerful story.
Thank you. And real.
And real. Yes, yes. Truth sometimes is stranger than fiction, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's so wonderful to look at real history and see what really happened. The legend of Zorro built on the real-life exploits of multiple bandits, Joaquin Murrieta being one of the foremost. But there were other bandits. For example, there was a bandit called Zorro Sorrio, not a Quantum Leap.
Okay.
And he's the guy that actually wore the mask.
Yeah.
The cape came from Joaquin. And many of the exploits that we attribute to Zorro or built around the legend of Zorro were in real life events that Joaquin Murrieta actually did.
You were telling me earlier about a
fascinating escapade that he engaged in involving a dramatic escape on horseback. Tell our listeners about that.
It's an escape that you've seen in multiple movies, and it may have happened once or twice in real life, not as many times as we've seen in the movies, because it involves taking a horse to the edge of a cliff, and you've seen this in many movies, where bandits are following, or the sheriff is following, or the Indians are following, and this lone rider comes to an edge of a cliff, he makes his horse leap off the cliff and into the river, in which he escapes.
Which just seemed too far-fetched to be true.
It's very, very difficult to get a horse to jump down. It's against their nature, because it puts their legs in danger, and then they would die. So that's not something that they're willing to do readily. Joaquin Murrieta in real life was able to do that.
Wow, because he was an amazing horseman.
He was an amazing horseman, an amazing soldier.
And did the horses survive that?
His horse did.
Not the ones following him, necessarily.
No, the ones following him didn't. And not only was he a bandit, but many times he took on social issues. For example, there was a mining town that, of course, the miners, when they got off of mining, they were ready to have their drinks and raise hell.
Yeah.
And so there was a cantina. There was a woman that worked in the cantina. She was not a woman of the night. She worked as a waitress. But after they closed the bar down, some men took advantage of her.
What did Joaquin Murrieta do?
He posted a sign, if there's not justice, you're going to pay it to me. They discounted her and said, well, she must have been a prostitute because she was working in a bar. So they discounted her and said there would be no prosecution. Joaquin came back with his men and burnt the town down.
Wow. He really sounds like there's a little bit of Robin Hood in him, from what you were telling me about him robbing from the wealthy and sort of redistributing that wealth a little bit to people in need, and all of his losses, the terrible losses he endured in his personal life. It kind of reflects that old adage about one person's villain is another person's freedom fighter. One person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter.
Absolutely. And we certainly need to keep that in mind now in the political climate of today.
Yes.
We're villainizing the other side to an extreme, whatever side you're on.
Right. Or we have to be careful not to tar all people of a particular race because of the deeds of a handful of individuals is another lesson we can take from this.
Absolutely. We can't paint with a white brush.
No. So, once again, listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Victor Crosswhite Contreras. He's with the
Descendants of Early San Diego. And the parameters of our competition, just to remind our listeners, is due date for submission is May 31st. Winners will be announced the last weekend in June at the Descendants Reunion Weekend. They'll be assigned to professional actors that'll prepare them in July, and they'll be performed in August in Old Town State Park.
Well, we're certainly looking forward to seeing those historic stories of Old San Diego. And again, that includes the entire region, including stories here in East County. So listeners, if you have someone in your family with a story to tell, perhaps an ancestor, or you've just researched the history of your region and discovered an amazing historical character, please bring them to life in a script such as the one that Victor just performed for us today, and you can enter it in the contest, and perhaps, if you're lucky, you'll win that $100, and it'll be performed at Twain Fest in Old Town. Victor, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives. So he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away.
as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town, since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian gold rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the gold rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who are the people who founded the town?
Basically, Dury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Dury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two of the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in the creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddlebags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in the creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories, but I'm the historian for the cemetery too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery, and it's Dury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Dury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Dury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old. And this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s. And then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
These are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those us? Those right there, yes. And
wow.
Those were probably mind right here on site. That's Julian Schist, S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary, and it's hard, and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit, because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them, because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pick that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll. And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know. And
hit a hunch, maybe.
not Drury. Drury. This is the giant founder of the town is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Okay. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People are out there trying to get lucky. But, say from 1900, they were pretty much done, but then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay, thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Dayton.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guides today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain, because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot fun.
So then the real goal is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis,
right,
and those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and mm-hmm. you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple of pointers on how to do this.
You want the sand to go over the ridges. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. And what I do, once you get it in a pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in the 1800s? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U shape, right? You scrape it down into the stream, and you rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take the pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out because the gold is heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Stevan over here who's been trying his hand at it. Stevan,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of gold, and the techniques by Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually worked.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collector. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The
now
way
you're
that
talking.
You could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! your gold strike. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit, because instead of an entrance to the gold mine, they call an adit. It's A-D-I-T. It's a puzzle.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there. And we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there. And once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mountain.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light, and they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a nomadic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The nomadic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet, and our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet, yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries, and of course some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie. So we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full-service lunch menu, and, of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes. Got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore. Worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels, did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center. Ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there, and in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego, is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and, of course, America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This was great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.